This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Two bright minds in difficult times, with tools to cope. Thomas Homer Dixon and Yogi Henlin coming right at you on Radio EcoShock.
So many extreme events coming on at one time. Another atmospheric river, probably the largest yet, is hitting California as this broadcast goes out. Parts of Greenland were 50 degrees Fahrenheit hotter than normal. One Greenland town went to almost 60 degrees Fahrenheit, over 15 degrees C, in a daytime high. In early March, in the Arctic, that's ridiculous, impossible. The average high temperature for the capital city of Greenland is minus 5.1 C, or 22.8 Fahrenheit. Antarctic sea ice is at a record low. I have a guest coming up on that in a couple of weeks. But quickly, here is the story that never made it to mainstream news the way it deserved, a hurricane that lasted over a month. In his 1994 sci-fi book, Heavy Weather, author Bruce Sterling depicted life in a climate devastated North America. It included very long-lasting, perhaps permanent, storm zones. Now science fiction becomes meteorological fact with Tropical Cyclone Freddy hitting Mozambique for the second time. Tropical cyclones are known as hurricanes to many of you. Imagine a hurricane like Sandy striking New York and then returning about 2 weeks later to hit it again. That just happened over Mozambique and other East African countries. Freddy is also a worst-case scenario for storm surge as it crawls along the coast at about 1 mile an hour. Dozens of people have been killed, tens of thousands of homes destroyed, and millions of people in several countries became storm refugees. What is happening here? Are these the first signs of the big superstorms James Hansen warned about as the planet heats up? Hurricane, cyclone, typhoon, call it what you want. When it hangs around for a month, battering everything, you have a new kind of trouble. I'm Alex Smith. Let's get to our great guests. These are strange and stressful times. Crises arrive all at once. War, disease, and extreme weather from a destabilized climate. As Thomas Homer Dixon and Johan Rockström asked in the New York Times, what happens when a cascade of crises collide? I have been recording and interviewing Thomas Homer Dixon since 2008. He is one of the bright minds for the big picture, weaving in geopolitics, security, the environment, and social change. In Canada, Homer Dixon is director and founder of the Cascade Institute at Royal Road University and a research chair at the University of Waterloo. You may know him for his books like The Upside of Down, Catastrophe, Creativity, and the Renewal of Civilization, and The Ingenuity Gap, Can We Solve the Problems of the Future? Let's check in with Thomas on Vancouver Island. Thomas, in recent months we had mass mortality events in Turkey, the Ukraine, and a wave of COVID in China that may have killed a million people. Add in record-smashing typhoons in New Zealand, drought hitting both Argentina, and a winter drought in Europe right now. We can't keep track of it all. Is this the polycrisis you warned about for years?
Well, the concept polycrisis is a relative neologism, something that's been coined relatively recently. But the underlying phenomenon itself is something that I've been discussing and talking about, and my research group has been studying for a considerable period of time. The polycrisis label really got its first prominence around 2018 or so in Europe, in the wake of the refugee, financial, and Brexit crises, where people are talking about the conjunction of crises that Europe had weathered. At least it seemed that Europe had weathered them by that point. And then more recently, especially with the work of the Columbia University historian Adam Tooze, the concept's been getting a lot of airtime in his blogs and Substack blogs, and also a lot of conversation at the World Economic Forum, as just kind of a general label for the fact that the world seems to be incredibly chaotic, and we're being, as you suggested, hit by one shock after another. A lot of them related, of course, to climate change, but then we've had the pandemic and the financial and economic consequences of the pandemic, food crisis that was aggravated by the pandemic and also by the Ukraine-Russia war and the war itself, of course. And it seems like all of this stuff is happening. I think a lot of the commentators, including those at the World Economic Forum, think of this as just a, in a sense, bad luck. You know, just a lot of stuff happens to be going wrong simultaneously, and we'll weather it, we'll move beyond it, and life will get back to something like normal. We're arguing in our work that actually the coincidence of crises is not a coincidence. It, in other words, there are underlying mechanisms that are driving the synchronization of a lot of these crises that we don't fully understand. So we haven't unpacked the causal dynamics entirely, but it's not just chance that a whole bunch of things are going wrong simultaneously.
That's really interesting. On November 13, 2022, you and the famous Swedish climate scientist Johan Rockström published this piece in the New York Times. It was titled, "What Happens When a Cascade of Crises Collide? Is That Possible? And Could We Know What Would Happen?"
That piece in the New York Times was really our research team's contribution to the conversation around the Pollock crisis. And again, I think we were trying to push that conversation forward to new and productive places. We identified a series of systemic risks. Specialists in this field talk about global systemic risk. They include climate change, financial system instability, democratic decline, biodiversity collapse, energy, food crises, and the like. People, they come up with kind of a standard list of 20 or 25 different things. But what we identified, Johan and I identified in that article in the New York Times, is that not only are these underlying systemic risks amplifying in severity over time, they're getting worse over time. Climate change is getting worse. Biodiversity collapse is getting worse, et cetera. Democratic decline seems to be getting worse. But there's an acceleration in the speed of deterioration. In other words, the increment of warming on an annual basis is getting larger over time. So things are getting worse faster than they were before. And then the most important contribution I think this article made was the emphasis on the synchronization effects. That, you know, as I was just saying, that there's something going on here we don't fully understand in terms of the fact that all this stuff is going wrong simultaneously. There are connections. And we tried to identify some of those connections between the crises. But we really most fundamentally made a call to the world, to the world scientific and policymaking community, for us to invest a lot more resources to try to understand what's happening. Because you can't respond if you don't know where your target is, if you don't know what the problem is. What's going on in terms of the feedback loops and synchronization effects among these different problems? That was the intent of the article, is to stimulate more attention to this polycrisis. It's not just a coincidence. It's not just bad luck. Something else is going on.
Just for fun, I went back to a presentation you gave in March 2008 for Toronto EnviroFest. And speaking as the Wall Street banks like Lehman Brothers collapsed, you said, and I quote, "Shocks tend to propagate from one side of the globe to another very quickly, as we are seeing again with the credit crisis or something like SARS," end quote. Well, that's certainly aged well. Here we are with countries like Sri Lanka, Pakistan, and Argentina close to bankruptcy. And this time it's SARS-2, which we renamed COVID. Is there a difference now?
Yeah, I think we were seeing, and we have been seeing for quite a while. I mean, even going back to the dot-com implosion and the East Asian financial crisis back in the late 90s, we've been seeing these kinds of teleconnections between crises. And it's something, as you've noted, that I've been talking about for decades. I think it's different now because people are actually palpably aware of the increasing frequency and severity of these shocks. There's a natural desire to try to establish certainty, to have the sense that the future is going to be sort of the same as the past. And if things are going wrong in the present, then you just have to wait or push through and you'll get to a place where you get a kind of return to normal. Right? But there's no normal anymore. And in fact, there's probably not going to be any stability in our systems going forward because, when you look at the climate, we're simply pumping too much extra energy into the climate on an annual basis. And one of the figures I use is, you know, there's now an energy imbalance at the surface of the planet of 0.9 watts per square meter. So that means you basically, because you've changed the transparency of the atmosphere to heat, to infrared radiation with our greenhouse gas emissions, there's more energy coming into the atmosphere ocean system than is going out back into space. And the difference is about 0.9 watts per square meter. So if you add that up across the entire surface of the planet, that's equivalent to about 600,000 Hiroshima-type atomic bombs exploded in the atmosphere every day, right? So we're pumping that energy into the ocean atmospheric system, and that's causing the ocean atmospheric system to become more nonlinear, to move beyond its equilibrium state. So we don't actually know where it's going to go. It's not going to settle down to a new normal. And I think people are starting to recognize intuitively something like this is happening, which terrifies them, as it should. I mean, if you're not terrified, you're not paying attention at this point. I think the difference between 2008, 2009 is we were seeing, for those of us who are observing things, seeing the emergence of these new phenomena, these new kind of teleconnections and instabilities. And we were saying, this is going to get worse. This is going to get worse. Pay attention. And people said, no, we've got the systems, we've got the economic tools, the economic theories and the other theories to manage everything. And those tools weren't working anymore then, and they're certainly not working now. So there's a real palpable sense of intellectual and scientific crisis, I think. And it's one of the things that's driving, frankly, the discrediting of technocratic elites and conventional science around the world, because it looks like folks are just out of their depth, and they are.
And for years, you've been warning that ordinary, well-meaning people need to plan now what to do if a crisis does break the system, whether it's temporarily or for the long term. You say extremists organize in good times and bad, so they're ready to act in a crisis when we are vulnerable. And we could think of January 6, 2021, the insurrection there, for example. What can we do to fend off domination by violent people with extreme views when big changes happen?
This is a really fundamental question. I don't have a clear answer to it. And, you know, my original research, going back to my undergraduate days, 45 years ago, I guess, is on conflict and the causes of war and the causes of conflict. And it's something I've studied my whole life. We're creating conditions that, according to well-tested theories of conflict, will produce widespread civil violence, war, massive deaths, potentially. All I would say is that the line between a humane and constructive response to these crises and one where we're at each other's throats is going to depend fundamentally on the degree of social capital and the strength of our sense of common identity. So that means the levels of trust we have between each other, the networks of cooperation that we build within our communities. Part of it is you have to prepare yourselves in terms of your financial security, ideally as best as possible, trying to make sure if your house is vulnerable to fire that you've got appropriate technology, sprinkler systems and things like that. So lots of practical stuff you can do to protect yourself. But I think in some ways, the more important thing is building community, is working with communities so that we shoulder to shoulder address these challenges as they come forward, and hope against hope that the world as a whole, humanity as a whole, starts getting ahead of some of the underlying drivers like carbon emissions. Because if we don't get control of the underlying things that are driving these problems, changing the opacity of our atmosphere to infrared radiation, for example, if we don't get on top of those problems, we can't adapt our way out. Eventually, any kind of adaptive mechanisms or social capital we build will be overwhelmed. But in the meantime, there's a lot of stuff we can do to extend the time horizon and to work together to protect the good things in our societies and to build new approaches, new economic systems, new social systems in response. But here's the last thing I'd say, and this is maybe sounds a bit pie in the sky, but human beings, I'm not a big advocate or adherent of notions of fixed human identity. I think if there's anything that's true about human beings is that we're extraordinarily plastic creatures. We are unbelievably creative in our response to crises, and we're often most creative when the crises are worst. I don't think we have even begun to test ourselves in the face of these challenges, which are unprecedented in the history of the species. Who knows what we're going to come up with? And it's just possible we're going to come up with some very amazing stuff. That's one of the sources of my hope. It's the kind of thing I tell my kids, right?
Well, we're going to talk a lot more about that in your book in just a few minutes, the book Commanding Hope. So you did create quite a stir, Thomas Homer Dixon, in Canada's Globe and Mail newspaper under the headline, "American Polity is Cracked and Might Collapse. Canada Must Prepare." Do you still think that's a risk worth worrying about? And what about European countries? Should they be thinking about this quietly, too?
Oh, absolutely. Democracy is under siege worldwide. I'm one of those who believes that the fight in Eastern Europe is really fundamentally a fight to protect democracy. You have a profoundly authoritarian, predatory regime attacking a fledgling, emerging democracy in Ukraine. So far, democracies have more or less rallied. I think there's been a broad recognition in the public, the general public in democracies, that there's something very fundamental at stake. But the larger story is a grim one. And I have to say that the latest news about large language module AI, such as chatbots, is an enormous concern to me. You know, it's not going to be long before Russia and China get hold of that technology. And Russia and China are adamantly pursuing the destruction of Western democracy. There's absolutely no question about it. And they will unleash these technological tools on us, generating an absolute tidal wave of disinformation, fake videos, and everything else you can imagine that will be substantially indistinguishable from the real thing because the AI is so good now. I have no idea how we're going to respond to that. We have 18th and early 19th century democratic institutions that are entirely unadapted for the technological environment in which they exist today. And they've allowed us to build, in the arc of human history, remarkably humane societies for the most part. And they're under extraordinary threat now. So, yeah, I mean, the specific case in the United States, I was writing that article in the Globe and Mail. I think Donald Trump has a real shot at the Republican nomination. And if he has a real shot at the Republican nomination, he has a real shot at the presidency. Because people get tired of the incumbent regime, and there might be a crisis with China or an economic contraction or something like that. And you know, if he comes within 1 or 2%, even if he loses the popular vote, he will declare that it's fraudulent. And you have the risk of widespread civil instability in the United States. And a lot of states are passing laws that allows them basically to override the popular vote in their states and send their own legislatively chosen body of electors to Washington for the Electoral College, basically ignoring the popular vote at the state level. You have multiple pathways for a catastrophe, a political catastrophe in the United States in 2024.
So we may not know what the future looks like, but we know some futures to avoid, like crazy heat or gang rule. Do you want to talk to us about those two futures that you write about in your book, the Mad Max scenario or renewable life?
The second one is renew the future, the Mad Max scenario and renew the future. And I, at the end of the book, I try to unpack their internal meanings, what their fundamental commitments to principles would be, ethical principles and otherwise. So the Mad Max worldview is exactly what the term implies, you know, derived from the Mad Max movies, which I think are a pretty good representation of kind of dystopian, very violent future, degraded resources where small, almost tribal identity groups are fighting with each other using bits and pieces of sort of legacy technology scattered across the landscape. The key thing there is this is a world in which you have a scarcity mindset where there's a widespread perception that the world is a dangerous place and the only way you can protect yourself is through the exercise of violence and pulling together with other members of your small tribe to defend yourself. For those who are pessimistic about human nature, there's lots of evidence that that's where we go when the going gets tough and when you're in a situation of extreme scarcity. I propose an alternative in the book, which is one where hope in particular plays a very important role, which is grounded in a very clear vision of a better future, a very important role in sustaining a shared identity across larger groups where they pull together and try to address their problems together. So yes, the world is a dangerous place, but we know that if we work together, we can make it less dangerous for ourselves. And that implies that we have to be tolerant of each other to a certain extent and understand each other's interests and make some tough trade-offs in terms of the distribution of resources of power among us. You would say that that's something that human beings don't do very well, but actually we do it very well all the time. People forget that 99.999% of human interactions are basically peaceful and cooperative. We are in extraordinary times, and there could be extraordinary responses at the national and the global level. We've never been so connected together before. We've never had such good scientific understanding of the nature of our challenges before. And it's pretty clear at the global level that we either deal with problems like climate change and emerging zoonotic viral pandemics collectively as a species, or we're all going to suffer. And those who are the wealthiest among us will just experience the consequences of civilizational fragmentation later than the rest of us. Maybe they'll get an extra decade or two. So just enough time to watch everything disintegrate around them. That doesn't sound like a lot of fun. So, you know, that sense of emerging shared fate on this planet, that there's no place to go to get away, is going to be a very palpable motivator for people all over the world. You know, I get asked still, where can I go? People say, where can I go when things start to fall apart? Where can I go to get away from climate change? And I say, well, nowhere. New Zealand's going to burn too. You know, all these people who are building their airstrips and their gated houses down in New Zealand, they expect they're going to bolt to those areas when the going gets rough in Europe or North America. You know, if things really do get rough, there will be hundreds of thousands of people arriving on boats on the coastal areas of New Zealand. And what are you going to do? You're going to take your pilot's family with you. You're going to take your mechanic's family to keep the plane flying. And what are you going to do when you run out of antibiotics and everything else that we depend upon in a modern, globalized, technological, industrial society? So the idea that somehow you can escape from this now is just nonsense. It's craziness. So that puts us in a situation that my guess is sui generis. It's unusual. It's never before existed in human history. So we may start doing things that have never before happened in human history. Good things, perhaps.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
All right, perhaps it's time for hope. You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Canadian risk expert Dr. Thomas Homer Dixon and award-winning author. And now we enter a dark concept that is very unfashionable. Is honest hope still possible, Thomas?
Now, that's a very good question. So in my book, Commanding Hope, I start from the premise that hope is essential, that if we lose hope, then we lose our sense of agency and our possibility for making things better. And we're almost guaranteed to get some version of the worst outcomes that we can imagine. But I also say that most hope that is promulgated nowadays, that is bandied around by different actors in the system, is a hope that is dishonest. It sugarcoats the possibilities. It's not honest about the seriousness of the challenges we face, whether climate change or otherwise. And so I spend quite a bit of time trying to reconcile a scientifically grounded understanding of the world that recognizes the seriousness of our challenges with a notion of hope. I call it honest hope. I think it is possible. The kind of hope I propose is not a namby-pamby, sugar-coated form of hope. It's a very muscular hope. It's the kind of hope that you might need in combat, or when you face a possibly terminal disease, or you're in a concentration camp somewhere, where you have some good sense for the odds. But you also recognize that if you just give up, then there is no possibility of anything positive happening, really. It's interesting, you know, I speak to young people a lot, and sometimes they'll come up afterwards and say, so what are the chances here? What do you think the odds are of something like a humane civilization existing post-2100 on the planet? Some positive future for us as young people. And I look at them and I say, well, maybe 20%, maybe less. I'm probably exaggerating at 20%. But the interesting thing is their reaction. I could say it's 10, I could say 5, and I think the reaction would be the same. They look at me and say, okay. And they walk off and they get to work on taking that 20% and trying to make sure that that's the world that they fall within, or bending those probabilities so they can expand that number. There's something else that I think is important. You know, we don't understand the systems around us well enough to know that it's game over. The people who are prepared to give up and say, well, there's nothing that can be done, are fundamentally grounded in what you might call a mechanistic or non-complex understanding of the world. When you understand that the systems we're in are highly complex and they do all kinds of unexpected things, sometimes unexpectedly good things, and sometimes those unexpectedly good things can happen because of relatively small interventions in the system. But we don't understand the system well enough to know that there's no reason for hope. It's what I tell my kids. You happen to live in one of the most exciting times of human history. Everything's on the line here. And we have no adequate understanding of what's happening around us. So there are all kinds of potentially positive possibilities that have yet to be explored. That's what the Cascade Institute that I'm running is about, by the way. It's basically an institute that's designed to find those possibilities in what the complexity science Stuart Kaufman calls the adjacent possible, which is the boundary, but just beyond what we see and recognize as visible and real. Just beyond that area, he calls that the adjacent possible. And that's a place where you have all kinds of combinatorial possibilities, possibilities for novelty that aren't recognized yet, new kinds of combinations of ideas or technologies or normative principles that haven't been tried before. Given that the world global system is under such enormous stress now, one would expect that new things are going to happen. And not all of them are going to be bad. Some of them might be radically good.
We recently had a mental health expert on Radio EcoShock, and she suggested the more we throw facts at people we disagree with, the more entrenched they become. And you talk about approaching people's worldviews instead, if I got that right. It sounds a bit vague. What do you mean?
Well, I think your mental health expert is probably right, okay? Because I think that, especially in scary circumstances, when people think the world is becoming increasingly dangerous, they tend to hold on to deep assumptions about what makes the world work. And it doesn't matter what kinds of facts you throw at them. It's very unlikely you're going to convince them with facts alone. The form of hope I advocate is a form that is deeply informed by facts and scientific understanding. I'm not naive enough to think that you can just promulgate that and convince others to adopt it just on the basis of rational argument. So I spend a lot of time at the end of the book talking about how we essentially get inside other people's heads and understand how they see the world, what's scaring them, what their fundamental commitments are, what their, what I call hero projects are, what gives meaning to their lives. And then working with those understandings to try to build a future that is both honest but grounded in their understanding and their interests, a future vision of the world that makes sense to them, given their worldview. That's basically what I mean. So this is what I would call astute hope. This is hope that there are three kinds of hope I advocate, three coupled forms of hope: honest hope, astute hope, and powerful hope. And astute hope is one that is grounded in an understanding of the people you're working with and you have to engage with to build a better world. You need to build their understanding of what possibility is for a better world in a way that respects their or connects as best as possible to their worldviews, their fundamental commitments, ethical and otherwise. So I spend a lot of time basically trying to unpack other people's worldviews. Now, it's not the case that you can do this with everybody. There are just some who are beyond the pale, and you're not going to be able to ultimately engage with them in any productive way. But I think in most cases, and I go through a number of thought experiments where I try to put myself in the mind of, for instance, climate denialists, or I put myself in the mind what my world would look like if I found out tomorrow that climate change was not a problem. It just shifts everything so radically when you go through these thought experiments. And you recognize that there are still ways of having conversations with these people and ways that we can move forward towards a better world collectively rather than just in isolation. But it has to start by getting inside other people's heads, figuring out whether you can work with them or not. And usually throwing facts at them doesn't work. That's not the place to start. The place to start is understanding how they see the world. So I provide a number of tools, one called state-space modeling, another one called cognitive affective mapping, that people can use to better understand the social circumstances and the worldviews of groups around them so they can be more astute in getting to the world that they're hoping for.
Where can those tools be found?
So they're described in the book, Commanding Hope. There's a chapter on each. There's a chapter 17 is on cognitive affective mapping, and 18 is on state space, or maybe 18 and 19. And then there's an actual tool online called Valence that allows people to make cognitive affective maps, or what we call CAMs, C-A-Ms. So these are concept maps, but they're different from standard concept maps. Your listeners will know probably what a concept map is. It's basically you take a bunch of nouns or concepts that are linked together in a way, you know, the concept of house and the concept of furniture and the concept of chair and the concept of people. You can sort of create a little network of the concepts associated with the idea of a house. But the difference with cognitive affective maps is that you actually load the affective valence or value, either positive emotional or negative emotional value, into each of the concepts. So if you feel good about a house, it's surrounded by an oval. If you've got color in your graphical system, it's a green oval. If you feel bad about a house, that's a terrifying place for you. Maybe it's a place where you've been attacked before. Then you were surrounded with a red hexagon. And what this allows you to do is not just do the concept map, but you actually get a very real and immediate impression of people's emotional reactions to sets of concepts that describe the world. And it's that emotional reaction that you have to be aware of if you want to construct astute hope. You have to understand what's scaring people and what they desire, what they're hopeful about, what they want in the world, what things make them feel good.